Have you seen Chuck Norris lately? He's still kicking butt and staying active well into his 80s. What's even more shocking is he looks more jacked than ever and seems to have more energy than guys half his age. And it's all thanks to Morning Kick, a revolutionary new daily drink from Roundhouse Provisions that combines ultra-potent greens like spirulina and kale with probiotics, prebiotics, collagen, and even ashwagandha. Just mix with water, stir, and enjoy. Unlike other green drinks out there, this one tastes exactly like strawberry lemonade and has hundreds of five-star reviews. Go to roundhouseprovisions.com/save44 for up to 44% off your regular priced order. Plus, every purchase is backed by a 90-day money-back guarantee. So if you want to experience smoother digestion, a boost of energy, and just an overall healthier body, then go to roundhouseprovisions.com/save44 today. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease. Results can vary.
Join Capital Group CEO Mike Gitlin on the Capital Ideas Podcast. In unscripted conversations with investment professionals, you'll hear real stories about successes and lessons learned, informed by decades of experience. It's your look inside one of the world's most experienced active investment managers. Invest 30 minutes in an episode today. Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Published by Capital Client Group, Inc.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to So Very Wrong About Games, a board gaming podcast about board games. Here we are in the historic blanket fort of So Very Wrong About Games. With me is the architect and manager of said blanket fort, Michael Walker. How are you doing, Walker?
Hello, I'm doing very well, Mark.
Glad to hear it. The blankets are looking especially resplendent today.
They are, you know?
One of the nails has come loose, but we'll work on it. I am your co-host, Mark Bigney. We're going to be talking about board games this week. We're going to talk about the games we played last week. We're going to talk about the news and why it doesn't matter. And then we're going to talk about our feature game, which is Deep Rock Galactic by Ol Steinus. So, Walker, what did you play last week?
Mark, we streamed a couple of games this week, one of them being Nocturne. This is a game that just came out, designed by David Leasy and published by Flatout Games. And it has very much a Skyrise feel to it. You have a number of tokens, like you would in Furnace, except more, and you're placing them on these tiles, and then other people can increase that bid by going adjacent to it. And then you get in the same sort of circumstances as you do in Skyrise, but much more, where you can win and then immediately play to a place that can't be played to afterwards, sort of like cut off. But unlike Skyrise, if you do that, then you automatically lose the ability to start the next auction type thing. And then it has sort of like all of the tiles that you're winning score differently. So it has sort of like a Euruspa feel to it. You know that Viking game where you're placing the tiles? Maybe you have not played.
No, I've not played Euruspa.
I thought
you just invented a new, very obscure technical
term.
It is.
No one will look it up. Because when you say it like that, there's no way they're going to spell it right, so they'll never be able to find it.
Okay.
Anyway. So you have all these different tiles that you're collecting, mushrooms and dragon eggs, and they all score differently based probably on numbers or, you know, how many you have different of so cards. There's also, you play two rounds of this bidding thing. There are goal cards, three goal cards for every round as well, that you're trying to do, like get your tokens in certain formations or separate. And you're also collecting recipe cards, because all these tiles have sort of symbols on them as well. And one of the tiles you collect lets you draw more recipe cards, and you start the game with some recipe cards. So you want to have certain tiles to fulfill those out. All of these things get you points. Whoever has the most points wins. I enjoy it very much, and I would play Nocturne again. It's a nice, easy, quick-to-learn, gateway-type game.
So it sounds like there's a sort of timed auction element with vague gestured towards spatiality combined with a bunch of incredibly bog-standard Euro scoring conditions.
Just so. So the time it takes, like I said, you only play two rounds. You also play like a little module where you get a leader power that you get to use once per round. I enjoyed it.
Nocturne. So, Walker, let me speak to you of the things that I've given up in my life for the sake of living in Kingston. One of them is a good Chinese bakery. Another,
true,
which has weighed on my soul almost as much, is Cosmic Encounter. Cosmic Encounter is an incredibly divisive game, and I can speak from personal experience that most of the people that we traditionally game with have no patience for Cosmic Encounter at all. You despise it. Huey despises it with a force and intensity. I don't know how Cosmic Encounter wronged him in some way, but anytime the topic comes up, he starts twitching, and then the rage begins.
Well, he's very anti-take that, and Cosmic Encounter is everything that...
I disagree. I disagree that Cosmic Encounter has a lot of take that. Cosmic Encounter is, I think, to a large extent, take that in the same way that Door of the Lesser Houses is in that it is shackled and situated in a broader diplomacy context. If somebody's targeting you with cards, you done did something. You deserved it. I'm saying that Huey is the aggressor here, not Cosmic Encounter. Anyway, I'm very defensive about Cosmic Encounter. It was originally published in 1977 by the Eon Design team. It more or less invented special powers in board games. And the edition that everyone plays now is the Fantasy Flight Edition from 2008 for two reasons. Number one, because it now has a whole bunch of expansions, almost as many expansions as the original Eon Edition. And number two, it clarified the timing issues that have plagued every prior edition of Cosmic Encounter, of which there have been many. Because timing is kind of everything in Cosmic Encounter, much like in comedy. And now there's well-defined segments of every round as to when things happen. And every card has a specific flag on it telling you during what phase it may be played and under what condition it must be played. This is what I tell everyone when explaining the rules of Cosmic Encounter, and this is what they ignore every time. Every time I explain, like, partially it's the game's fault. I acknowledge this. Every time I teach Cosmic Encounter, someone's like, okay, so how and when do I play this card? It's like, it's on the card. Yeah, but it says that I don't understand the timing. It's like, the card tells you when it gets to be played. Well, but if I play it now, you can't play it now. That's why you're confused. You play it during this other phase. And then they look at me, oh... And this repeats itself three or four times over the course of a given game. But is the price worth paying? In my experience, yes. Because part of the challenge and joy of Cosmic Encounter, in addition to just navigating the flow of chaos, and I recognize that some people don't enjoy games where you're navigating the flow of chaos, like the PAX games, like Senji to a certain extent, like other games of that ilk, you also have to just be able to figure out the cleavages and the weird ways in which the different powers and effects interact with each other and exploit those to your advantage. On top of what I think is a reasonably good diplomacy engine. I say it's reasonably good because it's very, very locked down. I think one of the things that people underappreciate about Cosmic Encounter, and one of the reasons why I don't think it suffers from a lot of the other take that failures that other games do, is the destiny phase. The deck tells you who to go have an encounter with. There's no picking on people. I was told to go attack green. Not in the sense of, oh, but the board state says, no. It's completely dictated by the flow of the game, unless and until it isn't. Anything can and will be an encounter, an exception.
So you can blame it on the card. Sorry, the card told me I had to attack green.
It's not even a question of blaming. It's a question of channeling the flow of the game. It's a question of determining how often people get attacked. It's not just offloading the blame. It's just that a lot of people deploy exclusives in our game group. And by a lot of people, I mean you. And this isn't even so much an excuse. It's just the way the game functions. It's got a great science fiction theme. It references all your classic science fiction franchises, especially the comedic ones. So there's lots of Hitchhiker's Guide references. There's also a Star Control 2 reference or two buried in there. So of course it will have my love forever. I adore Cosmic Encounter with any number of expansions, but I do appreciate the more alien powers that you get to introduce into the mix, the better. Not necessarily during gameplay. There are some people who swear by Cosmic Encounter, but only if you play two or sometimes even three alien powers at once. I'm okay playing that way, but that's not my preference. My preference is to everyone have one alien power and just deal with that. It tends to maximize the efficiency and effectiveness of your alien interactions. People get a little bit more comfortable with the dynamics, and I think that's for the best.
So how many players did you play with?
We played with six players, Cosmic Encounter with a minimum of 4 is great. Past 6, I want to play with the team variant, which is not ideal, but it definitely lets you play with 7 or even 8 players more comfortably. And there's also the expansion that allows you to play that way, includes extra cards to pad out the deck so as to try to preserve the ratio between flares and non-flares. Because flares are great too. Flares are reusable special powers in the deck that sometimes you get. And knowing how and when to play them and how long to hold on to them is part of the hand management, because Cosmic Encounter also does hand management very well, which is another thing I like. It's got diplomacy, it's got science fiction, it's got hand management. What else could you possibly like? What kind of human could possibly dislike Cosmic Encounter, Walker?
I don't know, Mark. I don't know.
What's your beef with Cosmic Encounter?
I don't know. It's been quite a while since I played it, but I just think it just maybe it's the time it takes and then the uncertainty and the
lack, there's a lot of uncertainty.
The lack of control.
Well,
not sure.
Yeah, I mean, there's less control in Cosmic Encounter than a lot of other games. It's certainly no Euro. But I do find that if you are careful and know when to pick your spots, this is what I say about almost any game with lots of chaos that I appreciate. If you know when to pick your spots, you'll find that there's more control than you might think. But I completely respect the fact that a lot of people do not enjoy Cosmic Encounter. But I can attest to the fact that the game we played won a lot of friends, and a lot of people were talking about the ways the various effects interacted. Let me just give you an example. For those of you that are unfamiliar with Cosmic Encounter, I'll walk you through how my power worked. I was the magician. And the way encounters work is that both sides play a card face down, they're revealed, and there's a variety of different effects that might happen as a consequence of that. Most often it's an attack versus an attack, and then whoever's the best total wins. But the magician forces the opponent first to play 2 cards face down, and then the magician takes one of those cards into their hand, and the other card that is left is the card that the opponent's playing, and then the magician may play their card. It's great. Walker is cringing in terror. But everyone has a power that is appropriately bonkers, and you just have to know that when playing as a main player against the magician, that those are the stakes of the game.
So when there's chaos and you pick your time to do the attack and you have that card that's great, so you put it down with the other card, but the magician just happens to take the one card that you've been saving in order to, you know, take your one
Walker,
shot.
Walker, what you're saying now is that the way to do well is to just save the one really good card. In a game where saving the one really good card was the sure route to victory, you would, I think, appropriately denigrate that as not being particularly satisfying either.
I didn't say the one good card. I'm just saying you have the cards ready to do your one shot.
If you were relying on one specific card to save you, absent the presence of allies, absent the presence of other non-encounter cards, absent the presence of superiority against the magician, yes, it's not going to work.
Copy.
You are correctly identifying the fact that the magician is a powerful effect and forecloses certain routes to triumphing over the magician. But there's always ways to get around that.
Now, does the magician play his card first and then steal one, or does he steal it and then get to maybe even use it against?
They steal first and then they choose a card. But I will also note that the input of cards, as a consequence of this, the magician ends up getting a fair bit more cards. This is a benefit and a curse, because any card that is in the magician's hand has to get played sooner or later. And there are a number of factions whose powers rest on shedding cards, about feeding them to other people. And so if the magician gambles poorly or is manipulated successfully by the table, then they can end up with crappy cards. Say, for example, you're encountering the magician and the magician was unable to garner numerical superiority over you. You can play 2 terrible encounter cards face down and know for a fact that one of those is going into the magician's hand and they're stuck with it. So I'm not saying that the power has a serious weakness attached. I mean that there are dynamics that you can exploit in the context of Cosmic Encounter. Game of the Year 2024. I don't care. It transcends time and space. Cosmic Encounter was originally designed by Bill Eberle, Jack Kittredge, Bill Norton, and Peter Lutke, and it was heavily revamped by Kevin Wilson for the Fantasy Flight edition of 2006. Cosmic Encounter.
So the main game we streamed on Saturday was called Spectral. This is a review copy given to us by Bitewing Games. It is designed by Ryan Courtney, who also designed Pipeline. And it is sort of a deduction game. You're trying to figure out the board because there is a grid of cards that I believe is 4x5. And it is randomized every game. There's an A, B, C, and D sort of strip that goes vertically, and within those strips, they'll be randomized, and then the strips will be randomized. So the whole board is randomized up.
There's a certain amount of control, but it's heavily randomized within that structure.
And the easiest way to explain it is to go right to the end game, you flip all the cards up, and the cards will populate the board with some number of treasures and curses. And the cards, you know, it goes clockwise or two spaces away. Anyway, the whole board's, and then during the game.
So you flip up a card in row A, and it says, two cards over, put a curse. You flip over a card in row B, and it says, one card over, put a treasure. And so that, in turn, populates the points and demerits that will occupy the map.
And so during the game, you would have put out explorers into the sort of creases of the cards, looking at them, figuring out where all this stuff is, and hopefully by the end of the game, having your explorers not where the curses are, but where all the treasures are. Anyway, very interesting, mostly because the end game is so sort of wonky. Someone can sort of force the end of the game by putting all their explorers out in one turn. But that being said, the other players that have explorers left, the actual explorers are worth points. So that might offset it if you do it too early. Also, the end of the game will trigger if everyone passes. So if everyone's sort of happy where their explorers are, then that will also trigger the end of the game. Anyway, looking forward to playing more. Looking forward to showing it to you. There's some, you know, extra modules and a small expansion. So lots of stuff for Spectral.
Yeah, deduction games for me tend to be hit or miss. And the structure seems reasonably clean. And with minimal note-taking, I hope. I don't know. I don't think it'll crack my head wide open in an unpleasant way. I'm looking forward to trying it.
Yeah, the fact that it plays so quickly is why I love it. Because, you know, a lot of these games take so long, like a Clue or any of these other games that, you know, you're spending an hour figuring stuff out. And then it's like, you know, it never sort of washes out to be fulfilling at the end for the time it takes.
Sure.
This one was played in like 30 minutes. Anyway. Spectral.
Well, that's one of the reasons why I like Paint the Roses, because it's not just one logic puzzle. It's a series of logic puzzles that you need to progress through. And there's a certain degree of control as to whether or not they're always the ones where you need ample note-taking. But once the note-taking starts in Paint the Roses, I'm like, it starts to strain my enthusiasm. But as I say, deduction games aren't really my favorite form of game to begin with. We played The Edge Dawnfall again. I'm not a huge fan of the title of the game. It makes me sound like some sort of pretentious side project of a U2 guitarist and or a finishing move from a WWE wrestler. But anyway, The Edge Dawnfall is a two-player skirmishy type thing with a heavy emphasis on card play. And you construct a deck before the game starts. You draft your units before the game starts. And the game starts very much in media res. There's no, like, well, here are my front lines. I need to go march out to meet you in the middle, and then we start skirmishing. No, no, no. You can definitely have people right in the mix at the start. The rulebook actually says explicitly to encourage you to think of the beginning of turn one as kind of the middle of a fight that's been going on for some time. And sure enough, it does one of those things that I very much appreciate in skirmish-type games, which is to say, how can we simplify things? How can we minimize things like counting squares? We'll be getting to that a little bit in the context of Deep Rock Galactic. But in the context of Dawnfall, you have these large conglomeration of hexes. Anybody who's played HeroScape is familiar with that shape of seven hexes that forms a sort of larger hex. And that is how most range is calculated, especially in terms of movement. You then put someone in a specific hex in that larger conglomeration, but there you go. And I find that a reasonably good way of simplifying the mental load and getting you focused on just the ability of where do I need to be, what terrain do I need to capture, or what guys do I need to skirmish with. That having been said, the unit asymmetry is very pronounced, and it is emphatically elaborated by the heavy emphasis on card play, as I say. I do enjoy the ability to craft your deck before the game starts. You know, that in turn, I think, is more consequential, actually, than the choosing of units, because there's not a huge variety of units available. Everyone ends up with five squads. There's no points involved. And ultimately, it's the card effects that tend to generate a lot of things. Your faction, though, this time seemed to be very reliant on which cards they got and when, though, frankly.
Yeah, because where you draft those cards from is quite elaborate. Like, you have a faction deck where you can pull cards from, and then every unit has their own deck that you can pull cards from. And so you have to sort of decide between all of these cards, you form a 25-card deck. And within my particular faction deck, all of my units could like evolve and turn into other things. So I had to include those cards within the 25. So I was very limited on what I could take and what I could include in the deck.
It seemed a little bit like introducing some of the negative aspects of Magic the Gathering. Namely, you need land cards, but not only land cards. In the case of your faction, you desperately want there to be upgrades available at various times, but you don't necessarily want your hand to be full of upgrades all the time because there's a diminishing returns.
Yeah, I really enjoy this game because it's very much based around these magic crystals that you need for multiple reasons. And so you're always deciding on how to spend them. And you also have to decide when to take a turn to rest and you get them back. And not only do you get the ones that you spent back, but if you've maneuvered your units out on the board correctly, because there's these crystal sort of terrain pieces, if you control them, you gain even more crystals to your pool. And so you're using these crystals to play cards. You're using these crystals to upgrade or transform units. You're using them to modify your dice because you're normally rolling these yellow dice that are
garbage.
And then
it's a D6 minus two.
And then you can use a crystal to roll the red die, which is amazing.
It's just a D6.
Not only for the
attack. It's two better.
Not only for the attack, but for the defense as well. And I very much enjoy the fact that if you sort of duff that roll, the lower numbers usually let you recharge a crystal. So not only do you upgrade the dice, but you can also spend the crystals to re-roll the dice. So it's this constant choice on how to manipulate these crystals. Anyway, we'll always play. Great skirmish game.
Yeah, the economy, you're right to emphasize the economy because it's very, very consequential. If you have an economic advantage, it reminds me not entirely unlike Cosmic Frog. And I think partially this is because the crystal components are exactly the same. Although in Cosmic Frog, they're clear. It's called oomph in Cosmic Frog as well. And if you look around the table and you happen to see that your opponent or opponents, in the case of Cosmic Frog, don't have any oomph with which to defend themselves, well then, you know that combat is more likely to go your way. Similarly, in Dawnfall the Edge, if your opponent doesn't have any crystals left or only a small number, you can afford to engage in combat, even on unfavorable odds in many instances, just because you can throw money at the problem. But then, in order to recharge, you're forced to spend your entire turn, and that tempo consideration is very well done.
And then a quick thing on the resting that you just talked about, because every faction has a banner ability as well that is very consequential, and that also resets that ability. So it's another reason why you might want to forfeit a whole turn, like you said, to rest.
Yeah. I wish it weren't a coffin box that cost $1 million.
Oy.
I mean, I look at games like Titans Tactics, which was a small box game that you could get for $15 when it was first released, and I wish that more tactical skirmish games took that kind of approach. The miniatures are nice. I mean, the models are okay, despite the fact that they seem... It's weird. The board is so big, it makes them look small, but they're actually heroic scale. It's strange. It's not a complaint. I got it in trade, but this is exactly the kind of product that I would never have purchased, and indeed, I passed on it twice during crowdfunding because of the tremendous expense. I'm very glad to have played it. I wish more people could play it. I wish it had been done in a standee or token-based game. It wouldn't have lost much. You could have shrunk the board. Cards would have still been a significant expense. It never would have become a cheap product, but it didn't need to be the monstrosity that it is.
I do enjoy that the fact that the factions are very unique. They're,
yes.
You know, no common tropes of, you know, elves and dwarves or Minotaur, you know, none of that stuff. They're all very unique.
Well, there's a dwarfy faction, and there's kind of the standard, like, good guy faction with an Angel of Death. Okay, yeah, fine. You're right. there's a Nature's-y faction and a dwarfy faction and
a
demon faction.
I played a Cenobite faction.
Well, yes. Then there are ones that don't quite fit into that slot. You're right. You're right. It is definitely more sophisticated than elves, dwarves, and humans and orcs, but some of them aren't necessarily what I would regard as paradigm breaking. But yeah, I mean, I'm very pleased to get the Edge Dawnfall back to the table. It plays reasonably quick. It's just hard to lug around, and it's a reasonable commitment in terms of the physicality of the thing. But nonetheless, it has some very good trade-offs, and it knows where to focus your mental energies on things like economic management, tempo, and unit positioning, rather than just counting squares and an endless slog of deploying for the next fight. So that's The Edge Dawnfall, published by Awaken Realms. It had a number of problems with the base game, and they revamped it for the 1.6 edition, and that's the one we've played. Still haven't played the solo version, still haven't tried the campaign stuff. I might give it a try sometime.
I love Darwin's Journey. This is designed by Simone Luciani and Nestor Mangione, and published by Thunder Griffin Games. And I played several games of it this week because it's on Board Game Arena now, but I think I feel as though it doesn't shine well, at least for me, on Board Game Arena, because there's just too much to track. Because you constantly want to know what benefits you'll get from moving your ship, what benefits you're going to get from moving your explorer, what goal tiles you have out, you know, what seals are available. You want to be able to scope the whole board, and I just can't do that on the computer version. You know, I could sit and take time and go over everything every time I take a turn and reinvest where I am in the board state, but it's just not worth it. It doesn't feel the same. So I'm sure I'll still try it on Board Game Arena, but it does not give me the same feel. It's a great game where you're taking animal samples from different locations on the board. You're improving, it's like a worker placement. You're improving those board states. You're also, you know, trying to make your workers better because you're putting seals, give them more skills, and you start with some skill cards that give you these incredible abilities once you've fulfilled them.
So question, the dead seals that you accumulate and put on your workers, are they similar to the dead animals that you accumulate and send to museums?
No, you eat the animals. The seals you don't eat.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Darwin's Journey.
Yeah, you've described why I dislike most digital implementations. I'm sad to hear that Darwin's Journey is worse than others, but I frequently find it so difficult to just get a quick sense of the board state and the trade-offs that then inform what I need to do when playing digital implementations. That's why when I'm willing to play a digital implementation, it's typically one of the very, very simple games.
Some reasons I do like it is because, like, the Orleans games I've been playing, I do need to go check some rules now, because sometimes you think you can do an action and it won't let you, and you're trying to figure out, well, why can't I do that action? Why can't I do the monastery action? Why won't it let me take a monk? It's showing that there's monks there, but it's not letting me take that action. So now I'm going to have to go to the rule book to figure out if there's circumstances in which you can't take certain actions.
Is the computer telling you you've been playing wrong this entire time?
Maybe. This is why I sometimes like it. It'll, you know, sometimes... Or sometimes it's just a glitch.
Sometimes it's just a glitch. Yeah. Absolutely. Played Life in Reterra. So let me tell you a story about Canada.
Do tell.
Canada produced one of the finest board game designers in the industry, a man by the name of Eric Lang. Eric Lang then decided to start designing games, a very tribute to his profession. And then he designed Life in Reterra, which is a Target exclusive, so only available in the United States. Thus endeth my brief tale of... Okay. So I acquired Life in Reterra from Target. It is a very, very... If you want to be fancy about this chain, you call it Target. I, however, only ever speak in plain English and would never dream of putting a French gloss on things when not necessary.
Not you.
No. Moi? Jamais. At any rate, Life in Reterra is a tile-laying game. Over the course of the game, you are going to be placing 16 tiles in a 4x4 grid. The tile placement rules are simultaneously very permissive and restrictive. They're restrictive in the sense they just have to slot into the grid. They're permissive in the sense you don't have to match anything up. But if you match things up in a certain way, that will then allow you to place a building. And there are a variety of different building sets. There are 15 different kinds of buildings, and every building has two variants attached to it. So there are three recommended sets, and then there is the possibility of mixing and matching. The rulebook has some recommended mixes and matches as well. And when I initially read the rules, I thought to myself, this is going to live or die on the strength of these buildings and what they do. Because I've basically explained the entirety of the game. There's some scoring nuance, but there's no built-in player interaction. It's just a question of drafting these tiles from an available display and placing them into your grid. And ultimately, I had a certain degree of faith that Eric Lang, this was designed by Ken Gruhl, would be able to inject enough personality and enough interest by virtue of the building assignments. And sure enough, that's exactly what happened. So, for example, the school is a building that rests entirely on whether or not you have more certain kinds of symbols on your boards than your two neighbors. And in the context of Life in Reterra, this immediately recontextualizes what you're going to take and what you care about your neighbors taking, and whether you should build schools in response to both of those considerations. And every set has built into it these player interactive features. And that's just one building as an example. And so although there's no core interaction in the fundamental gameplay flow, the building sets compensate for that. And so consequently, it was vastly more diverting and entertaining than I might have expected based just on reading the rules alone and without internalizing the effect that the special powers would have on gameplay. It's very simple, very quick, very approachable, but nonetheless, I'm looking forward to trying these new building sets and seeing what they have, because this is the kind of depth and nuance that you're only going to get from a really good set of variable powers. And so far, based on very limited experience, Life in Reterra absolutely has that. So I'm looking forward to further experiences with Life in Reterra. Very simple tiling game, but nonetheless manages to get a lot done.
You and I were lucky enough to get Undaunted Battle of Britain back to the table. This is designed by Trevor Benjamin and David Thompson, put out by Osprey Games.
And this is a review copy we got from the publisher.
And it is very much in the ilk of the other Undaunted games as it comes to the card play, but the movement and how the map works is much different. You're doing dogfighting, aerial combat, and there are a lot of aerial combat games out there that have a ton of rules and that you'll probably have to relearn every time you want to play them, and you'll probably play once every 3 or 4 years. This is not one of those games. They have designed a aerial World War II game that you could teach very quickly and play almost any time you want. Your tiles have movement value on them, and they have a maneuver value. You can move that many hexes, and you're allowed to turn as many times as it says on the maneuver tile. And if you're an ace, you can do that maneuver before or after you move. And if not, then you have to do it after you move. And you must always move forward regardless. And it's the same sort of activation system. You have to play a card. It activates that plane. And either you move it or you shoot it. And it very much gives you the feel of normal aerial combat games as well. You're trying to maneuver in behind. You get definite bonuses if you're in their six, as they say in the biz.
Ooh, and fancy terminology here, showing
off. You want to get in behind the plane, so there's lots of maneuvering and timing and figuring out how to gang up on certain planes. Every sort of mission has different sort of tactics. You know, it tells you that you're going to win if you take out the ace or take out a number of planes. So you might want to focus on the ace, or you might want to just try to destroy planes. There are ships sometimes that you can put in. Lots of
bombing
different
runs,
bombing
and
runs,
anti-aircraft guns.
All sorts of interesting things. Every time we play Battle of Britain, we wonder why we don't play more. All around great product.
So one of the key strengths of the Undaunted series, and I've thoroughly enjoyed every Undaunted game I've played, is that initiative really matters. And you've got a four-card hand. Every round, you bid with initiative with one of your cards. And very often, you really wish you didn't have to, because you want all those cards very badly. And winning initiative is super important, because if you play second, it is possible that your hand will degrade by virtue of the things that the active player did. So it's always been super crucial. I feel like Undaunted Battle of Britain dials that up to 11, because your units can only fire straight ahead in a straight line. They were just planes. They were just simple fighter planes, Walker. They didn't have fancy turrets and laser beams and whatever else you have in your 40Ks and your heat-seeking doodads and this, that, and the other. This is just, they're very simple machines.
That's right.
Look at an airplane. It's just an airplane. It's not a complicated thing. Anybody can build an airplane. Anyway. And therefore, you need to line up your shots and then hope that your target's not going to leave before you go and shoot. In theory, every time I play Undaunted Battle of Britain, I have the same concern. It's like, wait, how do you ever get a shot off? It's like, oh, you can get shots off. You just need to be careful about it. And if you're careful about it, you'll be getting off more shots than the opponent. And that's even before you start worrying about your command and control, because suddenly, in other Undaunted games, you end up with a certain number of Fog of War cards, and managing them is a crucial aspect, absolutely. And if you have a tighter, leaner deck, you're absolutely going to profit. But again, I find that Battle of Britain, for my money, does it even better than the others, because as you start maneuvering, you get this strong temptation to send your planes off and going and doing specific things. But the moment your squadron is out of command, if they're too far away from each other, your powerful squadron command cards, every time you use them, you get another Fog of War card, even when you're, for example, using them to bid for initiative. And that can be very painful. And honestly, I think that was what determined our past game. It was very, very close. We were both down to the wire. It was more or less whoever would get the next shot off, because despite the fact that it was scenario five in a scenario book, it was nonetheless a very much you have equal forces. They start off at various points in the map. Go at it. The victory condition is based off kills. And the tide turning, I think, was more or less about getting more Fog of War cards, because they really end up getting painful, and managing them is a crucial aspect. Yeah, Undaunted Battle of Britain is probably my favorite game in a series that I think is full of genuinely stellar designs.
Yeah, agreed. Back to the initiative part, because most squads also have you have an overall leadership card, and then the squads also have squad leader cards. Now, they don't directly activate planes, but they help you boost your squads back to health. They allow you to draw more cards, because you get to play all your cards, so drawing more cards is usually great. They will sometimes allow you to get rid of the Fog of War cards, but the problem, in quotation marks, is that they have a high initiative number, so you're always tempted, because they don't directly activate certain planes, is to play them for initiative. And so you can't boost, you can't draw more cards, but sometimes you need to do that in order to be able to go first.
Yeah, it's a tactical versus strategic trade-off, which a lot of deck builders try to do and don't, but the Undaunted series always had, and it's one of the many, many reasons why I think it's such a novel application of the deck-building formula to sort of a tactical World War II-ish thing. Now, I one of the reasons why Undaunted series has been foremost of mind is because roughly every 42 minutes, Walker has been asking if the next Undaunted Callisto has reached us yet.
So the great part about Callisto is that every... Are you ready?
Buckle up.
This will be about 30 minutes. It won't take long. So every Undaunted game so far has been based on World War II, and I have no problem with that. But there's just something about this sci-fi sort of dystopian version that's coming out is just sort of rubbing me the right way.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm very much getting excited and looking forward to this game.
Oh, so I shouldn't have thrown it out when it arrived yesterday. Yeah, Walker has been harassing me so relentlessly about the status of Undaunted Callisto. I think we're kind of in a screw you Canada situation at the moment, that I've nonetheless started harassing other people where the package might have been sent in error. And so even they are sick of hearing about Undaunted Callisto. So we'll see what happens.
There you go.
So those are the games we played last week.
First, we're going to take a quick break to pay some bills.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger for thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply. At Kroger Pharmacy, CARE is making it easy to get vaccinated. CARE is helping you stay protected from flu, COVID, and RSV. Seasonal vaccines are available 7 days a week with evening hours. CARE is giving you a shot at staying healthy this season. Walk in whenever is best and get multiple vaccines in one visit at your local Kroger Pharmacy. So come and get the protection you need while protecting those around you. Kroger Health, a world of care, is in store. Visit Kroger.com/vaccines for more. Restrictions and exclusions apply. See site for details.
And we're back. Mark, you like Sakura Arms.
I do.
I have heard that Japanime Games has acquired Sakura Arms. So what this means is we're not sure.
Yeah,
we
exactly.
We can hope it means more Sakura Arms will be available. Not only Sakura Arms that is existing now, but hopefully Sakura Arms, new Sakura Arms in the future.
At the time that Level 99 published their version, they published 18 characters, and there were already, at time of crowdfunding, three more characters in the Japanese original version published by Backafire that had not been included in the English one. And they said, not only will we include the balance changes, but we'll include the new fighters and the new characters once enough material has been released. And that was already the second version, the second time that the Sakura Arms had been published in English. Well, they either by virtue of rights issues or they just didn't want to or didn't sell well enough. I don't know why, but that wasn't going to happen. Now Japanimate Games has the license. This is going to be the third time it's going to be available in English. So who knows what they plan to do with it. Whether it's going to be compatible with the AEG version, probably not. Almost certainly not. Whether it's going to be compatible with the level 99 version, who knows? I don't know, Walker. It's confusing.
Why is Sakura Arms fantastic? Well, because it is a card battler. But you get to take two characters, then you get to merge their decks. And so there's a little bit of card crafting.
And a very small deck.
So you make this deck up of these two characters, and then there's range that matters, there's energy that matters, this whole system. And the fact that it's just so tight and clean makes it work. I normally hate that genre. I do enjoy Sakura Arms.
Yeah, Sakura Arms is great. I have... For a while, I had a source that was sending me the Japanese original, and then I was correcting it with paste-ups. That has fallen through, and so now we're just left in limbo like everybody else. It's an awkward situation.
And the art is fantastic as well.
I do enjoy the art.
Sakura Arms, now owned by Japan Games.
Japanime Games.
Japan, sorry.
There's going to be another expansion to Res Arcana. Res Arcana Duo. This is going to be a two-player expand-alone for the Tom Lehman tableau builder. This is the third expansion after Luxet Tenebrae and Perle Imperii. What I find striking is that this expansion is going to consist of a number of components, but in terms of the actual cards that you play on the reg, there's only going to be 16 of them, which is a very, very, very small number. But Res Arcana gets by on a very small deck. And so I'm always willing to give credit to Tom Lehman for tableau building design. And people who play the early versions say that, yeah, it's only 16 cards, but they get a lot of mileage out of it. So I'm looking forward to more stuff for Res Arcana, which is one of my favorite tableau building games.
Lastly from me, I'm just going to, there's a game coming out called Noterra, A New Beginning. And I'm saying it because it has things that we both like, Mark. I get super cute cards and components, and you get... anthropomorphic animals. So it's a win-win.
I like cute things too, but...
It's true. That's why I'm just bringing it up. This game just looks like super cute. It looks like a very interesting sort of worker placement type game where you're upgrading the places they can go. Lots going on. It looks like it's just like a little bit heavier, cute type... Oh my God, I'm going to say cozy game.
It's weird, though. I gotta say, they're less anthropomorphic than many anthropomorphic animals.
It's true.
So, like, and it is very cute. So there's, like, beavers wearing construction gear. And they're a little bipedal, but not substantially more bipedal than a beaver is. And moles wearing construction hats. Like, you know, so, okay, I'll give them a pass on this one.
Oh, that's great.
They have provisional acceptance to employ vaguely anthropomorphic animals. Finally, for me, there's a game on crowdfunding now from Phalanx called Lords of Heaven. I am always very nervous when particularly Western game publishers start to design games about the Crusades, because the Crusades was, how shall we put this, terrible! But they seem to be trying to take this into a different direction. So it's a four-faction game with two Christian factions and two Muslim factions. You've got the Crusaders, the Byzantine Empire, the Fatimid Caliphate, and the Seljuks. And so it's not... It's possibly not going to be a monolith. It's tough to tell. Like, the problem is that all those previous games about the Crusades are all very firmly from the perspective of the Crusaders and tend to either gloss over or elide the tremendous atrocities that were inflicted by the Crusaders throughout the entirety of the Crusades. But the decision to center, the Byzantines are often ignored entirely in the context of games like this, often just prostrate victims to be plundered. But the fact that they're a playable faction as well as two different factions of the broader Muslim world, I don't know. I'm almost cautiously optimistic.
Well, this came up on my radar when I was thinking about what we should talk about in our Patreon Pledge of Indifference, where we talk about crowdfunding stuff. It just looks so drab.
I respect that. I'm more curious about it from a cultural and historical angle, frankly. I don't know that it's going to be something that I want to play. It's just that when I heard that Phalanx was going to be making a game about the Holy Land during the Crusades, all of my available muscles tensed up in anticipatory concern.
No doubt.
But having looked a little bit about it, maybe there's reason to believe that it will not be, shall we say, a terrible act of revisionism.
Yeah, I kind of hope.
That's as far as I'm willing to go at this time. So that is the news and why it doesn't matter. Now we move on to our feature game. Our feature game this week is Deep Rock Galactic, which is a video game adaptation. It's designed by Ole Steinus, published by Mood Publishing originally in 2022. We have played the second edition. Ole Steinus is best known for his work on Champions of Midgard, which has been described by Walker as pretty good, and me as almost outrage-inducingly bland. Walker, why don't you give us an unhelpful summary about what one does in Deep Rock Galactic?
Deep Rock Galactic, you're mining dwarves set by the...
You're mining dwarves.
No.
So you are the dwarves lodged in the rock?
Dwarves that mine.
Are they, okay, thank you.
Dwarf miners.
That makes so much more sense. I was wondering when I was going to just chip away at the rock, and behind the rock there was a dwarf.
Dwarf pops up.
It's like, hey!
Hey!
Okay, that makes more... Thank you for clarifying that.
And so you're sent by the corporation, because the corporation is corporation-y, and they want the unobtainium mark, because that's how it works. And so, of course, this upsets the local bugs, which you just kill.
Are
because
like the
that's
homeowners association?
Because that's what you do.
Okay, you kill the bugs.
You
okay.
kill the bugs.
Okay.
What the native bugs, you kill them.
Are there bug
They're
miners?
In the way. And you collect the rocks, Mark, because the rocks are good. and
bugs
it's
bad,
not,
rocks good.
Not enough that you kill the bugs, but you must also harvest their young. And you take their young back, and you bring them everything back to the ship, and you have a certain amount of time to do that, and then you win. This is Deep Rock Galactic right here.
Okay. Have you played the video game?
I have not. I was tempted, but it's like a first-person shooter.
Yeah.
And my hands at the moment, not really first-person status making.
Well, I was mostly curious. So the video game's been out for a while. I thought you might have tried it before because it's one of those designed to be played co-op kinds of things.
It's true. It was on the radar. And when it came up for sale, I proposed it to the local group and they showed no interest. So.
Yeah. I might have been involved in that lack of interest. I'm not generally a big fan of first-person shooters, although there are some that I quite enjoy. And there's something about fantasy and science fiction dwarves that I just – it's always the same. They have Scottish accents, they drink, and they're rowdy, and that's their thing. And it's just – it's been the same more or less for literally 100 years of Western fiction. And I'm so tired of it. I really, really am. Anyway, that having been said, so that's why I passed on the video game pretty hardcore. And the board game was my first exposure to it.
So I'm going to start with talking about the setup and usability issues, Mark. Because the setup dovetails right into that. The fact that it's only about four large map sections. You have this giant board that is gridded off, and then you're adding these tiles to it, and you have four large map tiles that you add to it, but they didn't number them. They did put a picture of them, and they were easy to distinguish, but if had they put a number on one of the corners and then showed that on the map, it'd be much easier to sort of orientate them where they're supposed to go, and it would make building the map much easier.
And it is normally easy to differentiate them when in the scenario book there's nothing on top of it. But the way things are represented in the scenario book, they tend to have these, you know, towering standees that cover up other details of the board. Sometimes it's not clear where the edges are. Yeah.
And then we always both hate. Both the mission book and the rule book are completely blank. The backs of them are completely blank. So constantly throughout the game, you're trying to reference what certain things do. And all of this would be fixed very easily had they just put some quick reference on the back of the books.
Absolutely.
And then this is a cooperative game. So the monsters, they have a very easy and nice activation system. But there are a lot of rules for them that aren't on their cards. And there's empty space on the cards that they could have easily filled with these extra rules and stuff.
And this is the second edition. You'd figure you'd iron these things out in a second edition. They made some improvements. You pointed out that in the first edition, they didn't have reference cards for the monsters. Instead, it was just this single cardboard strip that outlined all of them. Now you just have an individual card for each monster, so you're only going to be playing with three or four at any given time. And that's definitely an improvement. But yeah, you've got this blank space. The amount of blank space and the amount of referencing that you have to do in the context of the rulebook, there might be a relationship between these two features.
And last but not least, they named the dice mark, which this just made it a little painful. The dwarves have all these different weapons, and they all roll different colored dice. And they decided to name the dice. Like, let's say the blue ones are armor-piercing dice. And you and I playing a lot of these games in the before times, when something says it's armor piercing and they put it in bold, which is double egregious, it usually means something. So I'm looking through the whole rule book, asking online, looking through the forums, trying to find out what armor piercing means.
It means blue.
It means they're blue dice. The blue dice are blue. Armor piercing
they're
dice.
They're blue. Yeah.
Same thing, they have like the red ones are called flame dice in bold. The red ones are called explosive dice. And so, yes, bad call on naming the dice.
Which is a bit of a disservice, because what they do with these custom dice is arguably one of the better uses of custom dice in recent memory. Often it's an excuse, a way to drive up the costs or just make things look cool, or in the case of a tabletop miniatures game, mean that you have to buy extra components from the publisher rather than being able to kitbash or substitute your own. But in this context, it actually works quite well. It's not even so much the number of different results, number of hits that you're going to get on a die, because that's all that they do. They just show a variable number of hits, you know, from zero to sometimes three-ish. It's more about various bugs are resistant to various types of damage, and it's very, very simple. If you're targeting a bug that is resistant to the type of ammo that you're using, all you do is the first die of that color that shows a hit is just socked away. So it's only the second and subsequent dice of that type are applied there. So what you have to do, in the context of a really, really tough bug just says, oh, I am resistant to more colors of dice. It's simple. It's evocative. It encourages you to be careful about your loadout. It encourages differentiation of weaponry, all with a minimum of rules overhead, so long as you've successfully immediately internalized that the things that look like keywords are not keywords, and they just mean blue.
The other cool thing you do is you get to chain the dice. So if you're surrounded by a bunch of little bugs, you can start, you know, you roll three dice and you roll three hits. You can sort of chain them along them and hit each of them. Something small, but is very interesting during gameplay.
Yeah, mostly it's relevant for crowd control when there's large number of smaller bugs. We never really got to a position where there was a particularly large number, because Deep Rock Galactic is pretty easy in my experience. And ultimately, I would have appreciated perhaps a little bit of an increase into the number of swarms to really get the sense of lots of bugs. Because, again, that's also my impression of kind of how the video game works at times, but that's neither here nor there. And it would have really allowed you to care about chaining those dice a little bit more often, because it's a cool effect that you seldom employ.
Yeah, let's touch on both those things very quickly. There is a way to sort of increase the difficulty, because you do have like a sort of a timeline. And it also dovetails what I was about to talk about next anyway, which is player count. It works great at different player counts, because how it works is a player will take their turn and then they draw an event card. And then a player takes a turn and draws an event card. So regardless of how many players you add in, it's just going to do the same thing. We feel as though the downtime might be a little egregious at four, but it worked fine at three. And so that sort of timeline, you can advance it a little further at the beginning of the game in order to make it a little bit harder. So it doesn't make the in-game part harder, but it just cuts down how much time you have to get. It
gives you fewer rounds, because one of the ways you can lose a scenario is basically by timing out. But that actually, in the context of the event cards, which is how the AI activates, that's one of my biggest criticisms with respect to the difficulty in Deep Rock Galactic, because it all depends on which event cards you pull and when. A non-trivial number of the event cards are beneficial. They just give you the opportunity to get extra stuff, sometimes at a cost, sometimes not at a cost. And then on the other end, there's, oh, spawn the worst kind of monster that exists. It shows up right in your face. Oh, and activate it now, by the way. And so if you draw lots of those cards, it's going to be a very, very difficult slog. If you draw lots of the other cards, you're going to breeze through and nothing's going to oppose you.
Yeah, this is a very common problem in co-op games, right? Is the event deck. There is an event deck in almost every cooperative game. It is sort of their weapon when you go against, you know, how are you going to randomize, you know, the game getting difficult. And it's this event deck, and you're always going to fall into the problem of drawing the wrong cards at the wrong time.
Yes, but seldom is it the case that the only way that the enemy forces activate is commingled in the same deck with a whole bunch of positive effects. So sometimes the game system is going to take a pause from punching you in the face in other games, but the enemies are still going to activate reliably. In Deep Rock Galactic, you can go five rounds in a row without the enemies activating or spawning at all, while you're just having either these one-time effects that may be good or bad, or just these bennies. And the inability to give a sort of arc is also a bit of a problem as a consequence of that. I mean, look, games can be too easy. That's fine. I mean, Spirit Island is often too easy. Games can be too difficult. That's fine, too. Doomrock is probably more difficult than it needs to be. But ultimately, it's just the fact that there's this fat deck of event cards that is not controlled by the scenario. There's only a very, very little bit that the scenario introduces. Some of the cards say, trigger this scenario-specific event. But that's a small minority of things. And so, honestly, I was less than impressed at the sort of editorial and authorial design that was employed with respect to how the opposition works.
Speaking of how the opposition works, a lot of games make it painful on how to move around the enemy or, you know, rules heavy. I think they did a fantastic job. Like we said, all of the different creatures have a card, so you sort of line them up on the side of the board, and they all have a number, and they're to activate in that order. And they either move, or if they're already adjacent to you, they will attack. And that's how it's nice and easy and works very well.
I agree. It is very streamlined, very simple to execute. At times, gives you a sense of palpable threat, but again, that's largely due to the vicissitudes of the event deck and the order in which things come up, and do serve as a good way to impede your progress through the map. And we should start talking about that at some point.
Which is the exact thing I have up next, digging around the map, because you can sort of look at the map and say, well, we have to get way over there. I don't want to slog all the way around there. Let's just dig around this side. And you can literally just, you know, recreate the map on how you want. It takes a while, but you can still do it. You connect to these, you know, unknown pockets, or you can just dig, you know, a tunnel around, and it's very interesting and very thematic.
It's my favorite part of the game. I think it's really cool, and it, as you say, it's extraordinarily thematic, so I'm not surprised that other games don't do it as well. You are, after all, mining dwarves, as I understand it, and in order to mine a dwarf, you need to be able to chip away at the rock that encases the dwarf. And the tiles that start every scenario out, the core large game board tiles, have choke points built into them, but the specific geography and the way the choke points interact with the broader mission objectives will vary from scenario to scenario. And so there are occasions where you are obliged to do that to get more efficiencies. And then there's sometimes where you just have to tunnel through rock just to get to the other side. Like the tiles don't all start out touching. Sometimes there's solid wall in between them. And so it gives you the opportunity to be a bit clever, as well as gives the game an opportunity to make things a little bit more difficult and sloggy for you when intentional. And just the ability to change the map is just downright cool.
The other thing we didn't talk about when we were talking about weapons is the fact that you have to track your ammunition. And so you have two weapons. You sort of have your main weapon, which you can switch at the beginning of the game. There's sort of two options that you can go with. And then you have your secondary weapon, which is this deck of cards that you look through and you pick whatever one you want. Usually you want to have ones that roll different dice. Another interesting part is that you can do something, take an action, sort of make a sacrifice, take an action, and overclock that secondary weapon, which just makes it a little bit better and lets you have more ammo for it.
Similarly, there are weapon upgrades that you can find on the map, and they range from really useful to very, 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 really useful.
Agreed. And so not only do you have this constant, you know, as you're going around the map, you're trying to maybe conserve ammo or get certain crystals you need for the mission, but you also sometimes want to get gold and red crystals, because as your ammo depletes, you can call down these resupply pods, which I find is a very interesting part of the game as well. So this pod drops and you can interact with it and get more. It has a limited number of ammunition of the two different kinds, and also has health. So you can sort of, you know, divvy up who's injured the most and sort of run up there and get some more health. And so you have to decide on when you're going to mine those particular minerals that you need to drop the supply pod.
During my first couple of games, I was actually a little disappointed by how constraining the ammunition felt. I was hoping that it was going to be, as I said a couple of weeks ago, I was hoping it was going to be a little bit more like Gears of War, where you could always do a weak attack, but if you wanted to spend ammo to really buff your attack, you could do that. And so the prospect of genuinely running out of ammo and having to use your pickaxe to fight monsters struck me as a little limiting. But they did actually manage the overall arc of the scenarios pretty well, such that if somebody's engaged in a lot of firing, or if a couple players are engaged in a lot of firing, roughly you're going to be expected to call in, on average, about one supply drop per mission. And there's going to be that period where you're a little dry, but if you're doing the scenario as expected. You'll have enough resources to call in the supply drop. You'll be able to refresh things. It'll cost you some actions, but nonetheless, it'll happen. So insofar as my complaints about there being a poor arc with respect to the event deck, I think that the arc of ammo conservation and resource limits were actually pretty well done in general.
So there's four dwarves you get to choose at the beginning of the game, and they all have...
Four dwarves and 7 years ago, our four... Sorry.
And they all have different weapons, like I already said. So they all, you know, one will roll green, one will roll blue, one rolls yellow, and one rolls red. But on top of that, you can sort of change those weapons around. But on top of that, they also have abilities. Some of them have zip lines. Some of them have, like, gravity bubbles that you can run across. One of them has, like, pneumatic drills that lets them, like, run through rock and stalagmites. So, kind of interesting. You know, you have a choice at the beginning of each battle. You can, like, sort of look at the map and see what we need. There's a gunner that can just, you know, unload his weapon without spending actions, which is kind of fun. Small little thing that makes it a little more interesting.
Yeah, you get little toys. The toy factor in Deep Rock Galactic is pretty good. You know, the weapon upgrades are toyful. The different character abilities are pretty toyful. And on the topic of toys, let us just talk about the different editions. So you have the retail edition.
I have retail second edition non-miniature. Like,
right.
Just the standard edition.
Yes. Yeah, so it has four miniatures, one for each of the dwarves, and then standees for all the stalagmites and the... I'm sorry, I never remember. Are they stalagmites if they're on the bottom or stalactites?
I'm not sure.
There was a mnemonic I knew at one point.
Actually, you could stick it in the standee however you want. So, so they could be hanging from the ceiling as well. I can't see how it would matter.
Stalactites come from the top. Stalagmites come from the bottom.
There you go.
So these are stalagmites. So they're all in standees. And it's fine. I mean, the visual effect is okay. Would miniatures be better? Probably. Would it be worth the expense and additional storage challenges? Probably not.
No, and the one thing I was kind of upset about is the fact that I looked into some, because I was very much enjoying it, is that the expansion seemed to come only with miniatures, which is too bad. Because they had some interesting miniatures where you're setting up like pipelines and all sorts of other things.
Well, it saved you some money though, because
that's true.
You may have a preference for miniatures over standees or standees over miniatures, but one thing you definitely don't want is both.
Agreed.
The only way you can do both is, I'll just call it the Gloomhaven model. Miniatures for the heroes, for the characters, for the, you know, for the small number that you're going to be manipulating more often, standees for the rest, that works fine.
Now, I'm hoping that they come with the standees. Like, I'm not sure whether they come, because they don't show you the punch boards. It doesn't say they come with standees, but maybe it includes the standees as well as the miniatures. I'm not sure. I doubt they would do both.
This seems like the kind of thing we should look up.
Well, it doesn't say, so.
Okay. Fair enough.
You never know.
Can we talk about my least favorite thing about Deep Rock Galactic that makes me almost hate the game?
Sure.
And that is the fact that so many of the aliens, in order to become deadly, cause you to skip turns. I have no patience for skipping turns and losing actions.
It's true. In our games, we didn't do as much, but in games that I played before that, we were helping each other up, which we should have been doing a lot more. And it just didn't occur to me when we were playing that that was the option. You can spend one action to help a dwarf up, or you can wait till it's their turn and they have to spend two actions to get up. So that's another option. They do a very interesting thing in that game where they sort of want you to stick together, but force you to be apart.
Sure.
Because there's lots of these event cards that we talked about that will give you a reaction fire as long as a dwarf is nearby. And so you want to stay together. And for that, also the other reason.
Too many knockdown effects, man. Too many knockdown effects. Too many stun effects. I do not approve. Stunning enemies? Fine. Stunning player characters? No. No bueno. Look, I enjoy Deep Rock Galactic. It's pretty good. It does some cute things. We haven't mentioned already the playtime is also pretty brief. It's about an hour to 75 minutes, generally. The setup is non-trivial, but, you know, you can play the actual scenario in not too much time.
If multiple of the players know the game,
yeah.
Setup is
many hands make for light work, absolutely. If one player is doing it by themselves, it is rather painful. But I have no patience for the amount of knockdown effects that Deep Rock Galactic throws at you. It is a very common side effect of enemy attacks. It is a very common side effect of various event cards, and I don't like it in isolation, and I certainly don't like it when it starts to mount. There was a time, there was an effect. Granted, yes, we were playing two players and we had split up. Absolutely. So to a certain extent, we asked for it, but you had to literally skip a turn. Yes, and then in the turn after that,
was I knocked down, but I was knocked down and stunned.
You were knocked down and stunned by a combination of AI effects, and so you had to literally skip a turn, and then the turn after that, you had one action. No. No. Should not be included in games. Find a different way to make your game hard.
Agreed. And we've talked about the bugs that you attack, and they have a very interesting variety. Like, some of them don't even move, they just spit stuff at you, and some of them just don't attack, and they just produce more bugs. And there are certain places where they spawn, and we like to hang out right at those places. So, like, when they spawn, they're right beside us, because that's the good way to play, apparently.
No, I think that's just because the scenario design has made it so that you're kind of forced to chill out by the spawn zones on occasion. If we were smarter, we'd probably do it less, but we'd still have to do it some.
So some of them explode, some of them shoot webs. I find them all quite interesting.
Yeah, I wonder sometimes, though, again, with my complaints about the difficulty, if part of the problem is they've set up this fundamental formula where the monsters either move or attack, and so it creates a kind of easy way to keep them in check, just constantly moving away from the melee ones and not entering the line of sight of the ranged ones. But on those occasions where they do spawn and then immediately activate, it feels like kind of an unfair surprise that we couldn't have planned for. So they're kind of in a situation where the only trick that challenges you is the one that feels arbitrary, which again is not great. I mean, overall, the AI is low maintenance, which is great, but not necessarily what I would call interesting or particularly sophisticated, which is okay. So ultimately what I'm saying is that all these things in conjunction, the fact that it's quick playing, the fact that it has a couple of cute things with the bullet chaining and the resistances and the light terraforming, I think it's cute, but ultimately it doesn't sort of elevate the genre the way it might have been able to do if it really leaned into some of those uniquenesses, and if the AI had been a little bit more curated, a little bit more editorial, and if it didn't feel overall quite so easy.
I think adding more stuff might take away, because...
Agreed.
There is a lot of games in this genre, this sort of like dungeon crawling type genre. And right now I even have one set up upstairs, and it's just so dense that will not get to the table. This is like the Batman Chronicle game, you know, second edition. And oh my God, just learning it. This Deep Rock Galactic is much like the other game I talked about earlier, like Undaunted.
Yeah.
You'll be able to bring it to the table and play it without having to like relearn it every time.
Yes. Yes, in that sense. Undaunted, though, I will just observe, just as a corollary to my previous comments, Undaunted in many ways is genre-defying and genre-elevating in a way that Deep Rock Galactic sometimes gestures towards but never quite gets to.
Agreed. But I think it accomplishes that feeling of we're all going to go grab a gun, we're going to go in there, and we're going to shoot some bugs, do this scenario, and get out. And I think it really accomplishes that well.
I agree. It is diverting. It is fun. It is cute. And another thing that it does well that a lot of games of this ilk don't do well is the scenario design overall is pretty well done in that there's a pretty good balance of when you need to be hustling and when you need to be shooting. Some games, the moment you stop and start trying to engage the enemies, it's a wasted opportunity. So yeah, they kit you out with all these guns and things to do, but it's a mistake to use them. Other games, it's just about racing from point A to point B. Or some other games, it's just, you know, there's no real reason to engage in maneuver. It's just you plant your ground and do the thing. And I think that Deep Rock Galactic does a pretty good job of letting you do a mix of both, play with your toys, and try to navigate the constraints of the levels to go do your fetch quest things. So that, I think, is definitely one of the reasons why I find it as diverting as I do.
Glad I picked it up. Deep Rock Galactic.
Yeah, it is definitely not something that I would have been inclined to try, but I'm very glad I did. So that's going to do it for this week. Thank you very, very much for joining us for So Very Wrong About Games. Thank you for spending the time with us. We appreciate it a great deal, and we hope to see you again soon.
Peace!
You've been listening to So Very Wrong About Games, a board gaming podcast about board games produced by Michael Walker and edited by Mark McMahon. You can find all our information at sowronggames.com. Special thanks to What Does It Eat for allowing us to use their most excellent song, FOS, as our intro. You can find them at whatdoesiteat.com. We hope to see you again soon, and as always, try to be right, but remember, you're so very wrong.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings.
Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply. At Kroger Pharmacy, care is making it easy to get vaccinated. Care is helping you stay protected from flu, COVID, and RSV. Seasonal vaccines are available 7 days a week with evening hours. Care is giving you a shot at staying healthy this season. Walk in whenever is best and get multiple vaccines in one visit at your local Kroger Pharmacy. So come and get the protection you need while protecting those around you. Kroger Health, a world of care is in store. Visit Kroger.com/vaccines for more. Restrictions and exclusions apply. See site for details.